Welcome to another edition of Sci-Fi on Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo, and today we're going to be talking about John Boorman's 1981 fantasy epic Excalibur. And Excalibur will be the first fantasy film that we're doing here on Sci-Fi on Screen. I'm going to attempt to cover fantasy, science fiction, comic book films as well, and I may fold horror into this as well in the future. My exposure to Excalibur started when I was 13. My dad took me to see it first run at an old ramshackle standalone movie theater in Bayshore, Long Island, where we would see films together. We saw Black Stallion there back when, you know, when you lived in the burbs, you had the single movie house, you know, so prior to the multiplexes. I remember being thrilled at it then, and I remember at 13 being kind of freaked out at some of the graphic nudity and sexuality. But I didn't really appreciate the film until I was well into adulthood. Now it's, you know, it's a freak out, as some reviewers like to call it. It's all kinds of crazy stuff in it. If you want to try to review it as a seamless, well integrated, you know, kind of a film, it's not that. It's a big fat mess, but it's a big fat mess that I love. And I don't know much about Arthuriana. You know, my mythology expertise really lies with the Greeks. I've just undertaken a small project to kind of read through Mallory's Death of Arthur and some of the other quest literature that's associated with Arthur, and I'm finding it that it's fascinating reading. I won't be really pulling too much from the myths as I review the film because I'm just learning about them. Boorman had planned a film adaptation of the Merlin legend, as they call it, as early as 69, but some studio rejected his concept. Then they wanted to give him Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And so Boorman did a pass on Lord of the Rings. He wrote a 3-hour, one-film script with this guy, Rusbo Pallenberg. United Artists rejected it. They thought it was too much money. Amazing. You know, it took how many decades until they gave Jackson all that money to make it? Boorman chopped the script around elsewhere. I guess they released him from the option or something, and nobody would commit to Lord of the Rings in the mid-70s. At some point, he went back to the original Merlin legend and then got a deal to do Excalibur. And a lot of the imagery and set design were told, and most of this information I'm giving you right now I got from Wikipedia, let's be frank. Supposedly, a lot of the things you're seeing in Excalibur were designs that were created for rings, which is fascinating. What John Boorman's Lord of the Rings might have looked like would have been pretty awesome to think. Although without special effects necessary to really bring off rings, I'm sure it would have been a big, fat, hairy mess. So a little bit about John Boorman. I kind of like Boorman's films. He's a very odd director. He's made films such as Point Blank. He made Deliverance. He made Beyond Rangoon, a film called The General. He's an odd director. I don't really know how to categorize him. I don't know that I can say that he does X or Y in all of his films, you know. He shot Excalibur entirely on location. You know, one of the main problems of Excalibur I'll get to is because of this. I'll say a little something before I start about the music. And there is definitely a soundtrack composer here, but he's mostly using orchestral passages from Wagner's opera, Richard Wagner's opera. I think he's using stuff from Parsifal. I think he's using stuff from Siegfried. And I think it's an integral part of the film, frankly. So let's get into it. We open up with some title cards, and I'll just, you know, read them in total. And the title cards say, quote, "The Dark Ages, the land was divided and without a king. Out of those lost centuries rose a legend of the sorcerer Merlin, of the coming of a king, of the sword of power." You know, it's very hokey when it starts off, because those last three lines that I read, as each one appears on the screen, you get this chord from, I think it's Siegfried's Funeral March from Wagner. So it's kind of hokey. And so then we're into the film, and we're right into a battle. It's an evening battle that's taking place. And we see knights on horseback. Right away, we're into Boorman's style for this film. What he's trying to do, and I'll refer to this over and over again, he's not shooting a historically accurate film. He's putting together this intense, gritty realism with this sort of Bapho mythology. So he's sort of, you know, filming mythology with an incredible realism. The only other film that even comes close to it in approach is Roman Polanski's Macbeth. You know, it's so incredibly gritty, and yet, you know, it's ahistorical. It's a play. It's Shakespeare. So what's great is he's starting off, he's trying to root this fantastic mythology in a gritty realism. As I've said in earlier podcasts, when a film starts out trying to get you into it as realistic as possible, I just think it has a better chance of getting you into the film, whether it succeeds or not. So you're seeing the breath of the horses, which makes you think that it's wintertime. The armor that they're wearing looks very heavy and dented and full of muck. And the men are carrying torches, and there's this, you know, just incredible chiaroscuro, these light effects. And you've got the Wagner swelling. And it's really incredible, you know, really amazing to come into this film with this opening shot. And then you have Merlin striding out of the fog, played by an actor named Nicole Williamson. And just another quick little note to the ahistoricity of this. You know, they're all wearing plate armor. And in the Dark Ages, there was no plate armor. They didn't have any. It was mostly chain. Plate didn't come until later. So basically, you're getting like 15th century knight technology in a movie about the Dark Ages. But again, Boorman is really, he's filming mythology. So it's a fantastical film. And you just go with it. And I think it's fine. The opening battle, you're getting a bit of how Boorman's going to sort of shoot this stuff. You're getting a lot of metal clanging, which sounds kind of realistic. Lots of blood, which is kind of cool. This is not a PG-13 film. I mean, I think Excalibur might have even been rated R. The knights are clumsy. You know, they're walking around in this pounds and pounds of plate armor, and they're bumping into each other. They all look very clumsy. And I like that. I like that because there's a ton of stuff on YouTube where guys have gone and donned armor and tried to figure out what it was like to fight as a knight back then. And, you know, they could barely stand on their feet for like, you know, 10, 15 minutes. It's very much that way. You know, you see these guys lumbering around like idiots, you know. They don't really look like cool fighters where if you, you know, the movies were done today, the armor's like feather light and guys are jumping around doing martial arts. It's like, no, it's not. We meet our first protagonist, Uther Pendragon, played by Gabriel Byrne. There's a lot of good British actors in this film. It's amazing how many of them are in one film. He seems to have won a battle, and he's demanding kingly sword from Merlin. And Merlin's basically, you know, this advisor, this sorceress advisor. And he tells Uther to sort of hold a truce, you know, and he'll take care of getting the sword. So then you're with Merlin at this lake. And this is beautifully shot, slow motion shot of this incredibly beautiful sword emerging from the lake held by this unseen hand. Merlin takes the sword, gives it to Uther, and with this sword, sort of Uther makes peace with his opposite, you know, who I guess they fought to somewhat of a standstill. I don't think the battle was decided, but it seemed like Uther has sort of won the advantage. He calls this guy Cornwall, I guess the Duke of Cornwall, and he gives Cornwall a certain amount of land in exchange for allowing him to be king. Cornwall accepts. They all retire back to Cornwall's castle for a feast. And you see both of them cutting themselves on the wrist and kind of mingling blood, sealing the pact. And so now you're into this medieval feast and everyone's kind of gross and grimy and it's trying to be as realistic as possible. You get Igraine, the wife of Cornwall, dancing for Uther. And, you know, it's a kind of a medievalish dance. You know, there's not like a ton of cleavage and she doesn't look like, you know, someone who's been made up and coiffed by, you know, Gaultier today. Like she's in like an old Celtic looking dress and she dances some goofy old dance. But Uther is completely, you know, taken with her. She's a beautiful woman, the woman who plays Igraine. So he totally plans, he has to have her. And I believe Igraine is played by Boorman's daughter. There's a bunch of Boorman's progeny in this film. So you cut to now Uther's army besieging Cornwall's castle. So he's basically broken the truce already. He must have made some advances on Igraine. And you're getting these now shots of a castle siege. And they're kind of cool. Like, again, it looks very realistic. These catapults that they're using, lit pitch that's put in the catapults is exploding on the castle wall, and Cornwall is sort of behind the wall. You know, the problem with this film and what unfortunately dates this film and kind of puts it in a category that's, it's not going to go too much further forward historically. The Foley work and the voice work is atrocious. And I assume because he filmed everything on location, I don't know, I know a little bit about movie making, but I don't know a lot. I know that most of the time when you go see a film, that every sound you hear when you're watching a film does not come from the place where you're looking at, you know, that all of the sounds in a film are scrapped. I don't know if that's true about the dialogue. I don't know how much, you know, real set dialogue they use. I know that they always bring actors back in to dub certain things where something has gotten in the way or the dialogue track has been compromised. And I think that's the case with everything, you know. But the Foley work and sound work in this film is very bad. It's bad in the battles. There are moments when the clanging of whatever they're using to make it sound like swords and armor and shields crashing against each other, that's really cool in itself, you know. All the other sounds and all of the line dubbing that's done by the actors, it's terrible. It always takes you out of the film until later on in the film when things get a little more intense. But the first, I think, half hour of this film, the rhythm of it, the bad Foley work, the bad line readings, they're just, it's bad. It's very bad. There's something about, I don't know, there's something about the way it's shot, though. It's beautifully shot on location. You know, there's a gritty, grimy realism to it, and the performances are very intense. I wouldn't say that any of these performances were any good at the moment. They get a little better as we go, but they're very intense performances. So, I don't know, for whatever reason, you know, if you can make it past the first hour of Excalibur, I think, you know, you might be able to appreciate what the film's trying to do. Anyway, you have this battle. Cornwall basically is successfully holding Uther's forces off, and Uther now begs Merlin to use some kind of magic to penetrate the castle. And Merlin agrees, but with one condition, that if he lies with Igraine, whatever their issue is, as they call it, the child is Merlin's when it's born. And so, you know, Uther is just lust-crazed. He agrees. So Merlin goes into one of the few times in the film where he does this chant of making, Anal Nathrak, you know, and the lines that come after it. It's kind of cool. Cole Williamson, you know, is wacky in this movie. There are times when he's very intense and cool. There are times when he's goofy. And you never know what he's going to do next. And there's sort of a part of his performance, you know, you're whenever he enters the screen, you never know what he's going to do. And I don't know, I find it kind of electric, even as it's kind of dicey at the same time. So Merlin stands by some Stonehenge-looking thing, and he starts chanting the spell of making, and it forms this fog. And the fog is sort of like a fog bridge upon which Uther can ride into the top of Cornwall's castle. And he changes Uther into the outward visage of Cornwall. So his armor looks like Cornwall's, and actually physically he looks like Cornwall. And at the same time, they see Cornwall leave the castle with all of his men in pursuit of Uther. So they've been drawn out of the castle. So there's no one there. And we get the first of these weird wailing effects as Uther rides across the fog bridge. And it's a goofy sound. It's like, oh, you know, think of the goofiest kind of 60s wailing sound, and it's repeated many times in this film, and it's as goofy each time. So Uther enters the castle. He's let in because everyone thinks he's Cornwall, and he basically has sex with Igraine. And we see he basically enters the castle, and you know, he enters into his bedroom, and we see young Morgana, who's going to be turn out to be sort of one of the villains in this film, the real first daughter, I think, of Cornwall and Igraine. Basically, right in front of her, this child, Uther and Igraine have sex. And it's weird. Like, he just rips Igraine's clothes off and starts having her, like, in his full armor. He doesn't even take his armor off. It's really weird. And, you know, it's a full-on nudity. And it's kind of a cool scene, in a sense, because Morgana's watching them have sex. And then they keep cutting back to Cornwall, who's ambushed then by Uther's men. And as Uther's mounting to climax, as they say, Cornwall is killed. And his moment of orgasm is when Cornwall actually dies. And they keep cutting back and forth. And they keep on intercutting with young Morgana watching. It's kind of cool. Definitely gives it an urgency. There's that weird wailing in the background, too, which is kind of odd. It's kind of gonzo. You know, Uther leaves. And later, Cornwall's brought back into the castle dead. And, of course, Igraine is, you know, doesn't understand how this is possible since Cornwall was there and they had sex that night. So then the next moment in this movie is 9 months later. Igraine has given birth to her and Uther's child. Now, she doesn't think it's Uther's. Basically, Uther has taken her as his queen now that Cornwall is dead. Once Uther sees his young son, he seems to want to renounce violence and battle. He's like, I've grown weary of battle and I need to learn how to love men. And you know, he looks at his son and he's like, you know, I will learn with you how to love men. And he wants to become a father. But this is not to be. And Merlin enters at that moment and basically takes the child. And he's angry about it. And of course, you know, Igraine's freaking out. And Merlin leaves with the child. And then we cut to Merlin walking through the forest. And Uther and his men are in pursuit of Merlin. He's decided that he's not going to stand for it. And he's going to get his son back. Uther and his men are then waylaid by these bandits, I guess, who happen to have come upon them, because here's the king out in the open with not a lot of men around him, so he's been ambushed. And in this skirmish, you know, one of the scenes we get an enemy hacking off, you know, someone's arm and the blood spurting out. It's pretty intense and pretty cool. I mean, in terms of a fantasy adventure, you know, that again, it's very realistic when we see these guys fighting each other. There's always blood. Uther's the last one alive, and he's being killed by his enemies, and he manages to stumble towards this huge stone. And he knows he's dying, and he's like, if I can't have Excalibur, no one will. And he plunges Excalibur into the stone, and then he dies. And again, so this is the end of the opening sequence, because after this, we're going to cut to Arthur. So we'll go forward in time. But this whole opening sequence is rife with really bad acting and bad timing in terms of the line dubbing and Foley work. It's just off. Just something about the film just feels off. Like, you know, they started the whole sound like maybe half a skosh too late or too early. It's just very odd. And yet they're setting the theme up here. You know, Uther's bargain is this sort of fool's bargain, and his quest to attain power and women and all this stuff. He loses the thing that in the moment when his son is born is he realizes is the most precious thing there is. But he's made a deal, you know, so he gets everything he wants, realizes that all of it's just kind of worthless without this, you know, the love that he could have with this son of his. But he's, in a sense, the theme is that, you know, that's not for him, that he's already bargained it away, which is great. And there'll be more of this, you know, to come in the future of the film. You know, we're also getting this setup of how grimy and how realistic this is going to be, what kind of a mashup that is. So now the setting is of a little market tournament, as it were. We're getting a lot of, you know, people just gathered in the forest for some kind of fair. And we meet Arthur and Kay. And Arthur's played by this actor named Nigel Terry. His brother is Sir Kay, who actually is a knight. Arthur is a squire. And they're brothers. What we come to understand is that every year there's this fair and tournament by where the Excalibur has been put into the stone. And knights sort of go into an area and they beat the crap out of each other. And the one who survives earns the right to go try to pull the sword from the stone. And in all these years since Uther put it there, no one has been able to do it. We get into this first little skirmish of knights and we see a 41-year-old Patrick Stewart as a lord named Leon de Grance, who turns out to be one of Arthur's early allies. He looks great. And we see them jousting. And again, it's not this sort of jousting we're used to where it's at a tournament and they line up and they take long runs at each other. They're all just, you know, riding around in a circle with lances that maybe 5 or 6 feet long, just kind of hacking at each other and whacking each other. I like the realism of it. You know, I feel like I'm sure they jousted in the way that, you know, we know jousting, but I'm sure that most of this kind of battling was done exactly the way or similarly to the way Borman depicts it. Guys are whacking each other with swords and with lances, and it all looks just so clumsy. You know, none of it looks like, you know, the best knight is the knight who's just really kind of the strongest and who can beat the crap out of the other guys. Not this incredible, you know, 21st century filmmaking, you know, swordsman, martial artist kind of crap. It's just beating the shit out of each other. And again, the Foley work is not great. You know, they're trying and they're really going after good metal on metal sounds, but there's a smallness to the sound in this film that really detracts. I mean, in some ways, if they went back and redid all of the sounds in this movie and all of the lines, you'd have a different movie. Like if they somehow were able to correct this terrible box-like sound that this movie is about, that it would live, you know, it would have life past what it has now. But I don't, you know, think anyone's going to do that. In this initial tournament, you know, Patrick Stewart's character, Leon de Grance, wins. They all go up to the stone. It's very dramatic. You know, Patrick Stewart is blessed by this, I guess, holy man who's sitting next to the sword. He tries to pull it. Fails, of course. So now Arthur's brother Kay is set to join the battle because obviously Arthur can't fight. He's only a squire and only knights can fight for the right to draw Excalibur. Kay goes to get his sword and it's gone. And of course, him and his father kind of chide Arthur, you know, where the hell is the sword? So Arthur runs back to their tent and he realizes that Kay's sword has been stolen. So he's running around like crazy looking for a sword. And in searching, he comes upon Excalibur in the forest and the holy man next to it is sleeping. And he tries to pull it and it comes free. And he's looking at it and he runs away and he gives it to Kay. He's like, hey, Kay, you know, Kay and Sir Ector, who's their father, come up to him and after he's done it, he gives it to Kay and he says, Kay, I found you a sword. Then Ector comes up and he's like, asks Kay, did you pull a sword from the stone? And Kay says, yes, father, I did. And then he waits a beat and he's like, no, It was author. I can't. Like, he has his moment, and he's totally honest. Ector sort of like, well, put it back, you know? So Arthur puts it back in the stone. And then at some point, other knights come upon them all and realize there's some hubbub. And this knight named Uriens, I guess possibly you won the last battle. He wants to try. They want to let Arthur try to pull it out again. And this guy Uriens tries. And of course, there's drama because you think, well, Arthur freed it now. So whoever's going to come after Arthur now should be able to pull it out. But Uriens fails. And then Arthur just pulls it out. The legend is whoever pulls this sword from the stone is the king. We get the explanation that Sir Arthur looks to his father and is like, I'm not a king, Dad. I'm your son. And Ector explains that you're not really my blood, that Merlin brought you to me when you were a child, and I raised you as my son, and I came to love you. This is one little moment, you know, like, and Kay and Ector are like very sweet characters. And this is the beginning of why I love this film, because there's an undercurrent of real earnestness and real, I don't want to say sacrifice, but sort of the notion of earnest goodness that continues to surface in this film as a theme. And it's definitely part of the whole, I mean, you know, chivalry is probably a joke, right? But the notion of chivalry is that when you undertook the code of chivalry, when you became a knight, that you were pledging yourself, and you're definitely pledging yourself to God because it was a very religious thing. And you were pledging yourself and sort of promising to be a good man, you know, and to do noble works and to defend the land and to defend the innocent and so on and so forth. Like most things, you know, the notions of chivalry were great. Now, whether they were ever really carried out by anybody and they ever lived in the real world, who knows? But the mythological notions of chivalry definitely come up here. And that's why I love this film, is that there's a spiritual element that runs through this wacky film that I think is just very powerful. The cool thing is what happens here is that no one accepts Arthur as a king. He's this boy from nowhere, except Patrick Stewart's character, Leon de Grance, who says, I accept the boy. And immediately Merlin leaves. Arthur kind of runs after him. And we hear that weird wailing song again. And now there's this sort of vigil between Arthur and Merlin. And in the middle of the forest, Merlin's sleeping and Arthur's there with him. And Merlin is explaining sort of the mythology of this film, which is the notion of what the dragon is. You know, earlier we've gotten this notion of the dragon's breath. And later on we'll get, you know, what the dragon is, that the dragon is the land. The land is the dragon. And that it's part of sort of the power of this world, that it's everywhere. And that it's connected to Arthur and Arthur to it. You know, there is this connection that he has to the land, which is very special, which is why he is who he is. There's a weird visual here where Arthur's walking around looking at animals, and I think what the filmmaker tried to do is to give you a sense that Arthur's connected to the land, so all of these animals are sort of emerging, possibly to greet their new king, you know, and Arthur has a very special relationship to the animals and the plants and the trees and everything in this world that we're seeing. But it's an odd thing. And basically, we get to the point where Arthur is asking Merlin, like, what do I do next? I don't know how to be king. What should I do? Merlin kind of advises him, like, this Leon de Grance is the only noble who's with you, and his castle is under siege by all these other knights. And then Arthur's like, well, we should go and help him. And Merlin's like, there you go. First act is king. Let's go help him. And off they go. So now we cut to Leon de Grance in his castle being besieged by the surrounding troops. And, you know, a very small scale, which I think is realistic in terms of, you know, Dark Ages, medieval battles. You know, they weren't these hundreds of thousands. They were smaller groups. But this seems very small. Like, the scale of this is, you know, there's probably maybe 3 dozen knights maybe besieging this castle, which I like. I kind of like that it's, you know, it's more realistic, that we're not getting siege engines like Lord of the Rings, because it's the Dark Ages. Like, it wasn't organized on that scale yet. And there's some good fighting, actually, in this sequence. You see the enemy putting up these siege towers and how they're getting into the castle, and it's all done very realistically. You know, you're definitely getting a sense of the heaviness of all the armor that's being worn, and Bormann shoots so well. I mean, most of the shots in this film are just done with such beauty. It's almost as if Ridley Scott was behind the camera. You know, it has that Ridley-ness to like Ridley's early films. Really beautiful. Film has this music, Carmina Burana, which is by this composer, Carl Orff, which, you know, if I played it for you now, you'd be like, oh, that? Because it's like in every trailer ever written, every fantasy tinge trailer ever written. It's churning underneath the battle, and the Foley work sucks, and you just, you know, you have to kind of get used to it or not if you want to keep going in this film. But what's cool about this is we get a sense, because of the editing, I can follow the battle. I can follow Arthur climbing up, putting a hook on a siege tower, and then Merlin spurring horses, and it falls over, and then Arthur kind of jumping up on the parapet to help, and then, you know, the siege coming from the other side of the castle, and you know, just Arthur's efforts and him wielding Excalibur, which is kind of goofy. And we see Leon de Grance's daughter, Guinevere, watching Arthur kind of, you know, kick ass. And then there's this moment when there's a very realistic killing of a knight where Arthur's on the parapet and he's face to face with this knight, and he's like looking for open spots in the armor and then jamming Excalibur into the spots to kill, and he pulls it out and finds another one. There's a lot in this movie and a lot of other movies with, you know, knights where like one knight hits another knight in the chest with the sword and the knight falls down, and it's like, why did he fall down? The armor protected him. If you read a little bit about medieval warfare, you realize that a lot of times the sword was held two-handed. It's more about finding holes in the enemy's armor and jamming your, you know, sword into those unexposed places in the armpit, in the waist, the knee, places where you could get inside the and hit the body, that you weren't just swinging for the guy's chest or you know. And unfortunately, in this film too, there's a lot of, you know, Arthur hits a couple of people with Excalibur and they just drop. But this one shot, I wish there would have been more of it, was really cool about how a medieval knight might be killed or how two medieval knights might fight. So I really, really liked it. So then comes my favorite part of the movie. Arthur helps Leon de Grance sort of defeat all the knights on the parapet of the castle, so that's safe. And he sees Uriens, who's one of the knights, who's sort of leading, kind of the lead knight of the enemy forces. And Arthur jumps off the parapet and knocks Uriens off his horse. And they fight briefly, and Arthur basically has Uriens at his mercy. So Uriens goes down on his knees, and Arthur has Excalibur right up to his neck. And everybody pauses. You know, Arthur says to Uriens, you know, "I need battle lords such as you. Swear fealty to me, and I'll spare you." And Uriens is like, "A knight, you know, swearing to a squire? Never." So Arthur's like, "You're right, I'm not a knight." And then he says, "You, Uriens, will knight me." And he gives Uriens Excalibur, and Arthur goes down on his knees. And Uriens gets up, holding the sword, and there's this incredible tension. And Merlin comes out of the crowd, and he's like, "I never saw this, you know, what is this?" And so this great sound cue, I don't even know what it is, but it's like this one note is held underneath, and all the fighting stops all around them, and everyone's gathering, and you hear someone yell from the background, "Keep it, Uriens!" And Uriens is looking at the sword, looking down at Arthur, and Arthur's just there. Then the Wagner kind of swells, and Uriens knights him, and then gives Arthur the sword, and Uriens drops to his knees, and it's this incredible moment. Uriens swears allegiance, and because earlier, Merlin had told the crowd that this is Uther Pendragon's son. You know, nobody believed him. At the end of the scene, Uriens says, "I swear allegiance to the courage in your veins, whose source must be Uther Pendragon. I doubt you no more." And it's one of the most beautiful scenes, my favorite scene in this film, because it's so beautiful, in that this is, in its idealized sense, this sort of Christian chivalric notion that you would put upon the enemy the choice to do right, you know, in this way, that Arthur just puts all this trust and this incredible onus on Uriens of like, "I believe in you. I believe that as a knight, you're going to do the right thing here and not cut off my head and take the sword for yourself." And then Uriens is devastated by it. He's completely humbled and taken by it. And it's no shame on Uriens. Like, it's no shame on him, and everyone else knows it, you know? It's such a beautiful scene. I know if they ever remake Excalibur, this will be completely eviscerated. This whole vein of this sort of chivalric sense of humbling oneself to either God or to some greater power or to the sense of goodness that's inherent and shared by all men and women. It's such a beautiful vein in this movie, and I know that if it's remade in this day and age, it will be completely gone. So after the battle, Arthur has been wounded, has been cut several times, and there's a scene where Guinevere is sewing him up. It's the, kind of their meet-cute scene. It's kind of cute. She's doing things, and Arthur's just watching her and definitely in love with her. And later on, that evening, the castle, he's watching her dance, and him and Merlin are having this discussion about love, and Merlin can see that Arthur's just head over heels, and he's just, you know, exasperated, you know, remembering what Uther had done. Now they're traveling as a troop. We're not sure where. The next scene, this beautiful landscape, we see that there is this knight that is holding a very narrow bridge. All of Arthur's knights are trying to go over the bridge, and this knight is beating them all. And it's really beautifully shot scene. There's a terrible scene between Merlin and Arthur walking in this very shallow pool, and Merlin's looking for fish, and the fish slips out of his hand, and he loses his balance and falls down, and just bizarre. I don't know why it's even in the movie. It's really weird. So everyone fails, and Arthur decides he's going to then go up against this knight, and the knight introduces himself as Lancelot of the Lake, Sir Lancelot, and he's in this wonderfully bright and shining armor, and he's defending the pass, and it's a little goofy. Like, he's just there with, and he's living in these tents, and there are all kinds of lances, and he's just, like, there to joust. Which is a really good joust scene. It's one of the more of a classic-looking joust scene where, you know, they start a long ways away from each other and hone in. Actually, Arthur loses the joust, and then Lancelot sort of has him at his mercy, and Arthur's like, get off your horse and fight. Lancelot is Arthur's master. It's evident to Lancelot, and he won't kill Arthur, so he's just sort of batting Arthur away and knocking him on his butt. You know, it's very clumsily shot as well. And, you know, I think more and more, like, Boorman is just trying to get at that knights in these kind of armor. Like, it's very a clumsy, awkward way to wage war against someone else, you know, fighting in, like, a little tank. So at one point, Arthur is thrown upon some rocks, and he is about to be killed by Lancelot. And he calls upon the power of Excalibur, and it cleaves through the weapon that Lancelot is using and sort of smites him on the armor with such power that Lancelot himself is just completely thrown back and down. But at the same time, Excalibur is broken. And we have part of the, you know, metaphor rising up again in this film. Arthur is really despondent. Look what I've done, Merlin. And Merlin's like, I'm not sure what you should do. And Arthur realizes that what he says is, my pride broke it. My rage broke it. And that in this knight simply standing up to him. And in a sense, Lancelot, even during the duel, tells him, you know, it doesn't make any sense. You can easily ride around this bridge. Why would you go through all this? And so it's, you know, sort of Arthur's stubbornness and has kind of broken his blade. And Arthur's devastated. He's devastated. And in that moment, he kind of is understanding the purpose of the sword, in a sense, to unite men, not to serve. And he says it's to unite men rather than serve the vanity of one man, which is him speaking all these lines is very didactic and clumsy, unfortunately. You know, they're telling the viewer kind of what to think. Again, it's the underlying message in this film. You know, there is an underlying spiritual journey going on in this film that Arthur is undertaking, and other knights who will later, in terms of wanting to be good and true men and what that means, you know. And so I think it's kind of cool that Excalibur the sword is something that can be destroyed by the greed and avarice of man. It's kind of a really cool metaphor, and I think the film's very aware of this. And, you know, as this film lurches forward on its bizarre, unsteady legs, I'm brought along by the music, by the cinematography, by the costumes, by the setting, and some of the themes that are bubbling up. And I'm equally pushed away often by the really bad sound and Foley work, the on-the-nose didactic screenplay, and, you know, most of the performances are pretty bad. The actor who plays Lancelot is actually a standout. He's pretty good, and he's able to make his lines kind of seem more natural than anyone else does. And Nigel Terry as Arthur, like, he's kind of a goofy actor, and he gives it pathos, I will say that, but not much in the way of depth and not much shading to the character. Merlin urges Arthur to throw the sword in the water. The Lady of the Lake responds by reforging it, and she's holding it out to him again. Arthur takes it. From there, now we're at the end of a battle somewhere. It's night. We're getting some scattered dialogue here and there that Arthur's united Britain has repulsed some enemy invaders from across the sea. And, you know, I think they're near the cliffs of Dover, although they don't say that. But they're near the sea, and they've repulsed whatever invaders they've repulsed. Merlin lights his staff, kind of, you know, some light and flame out of the top of his staff. And he sort of gives this wonderful speech about to the gathered to remember, you know, that they all came together to do this thing. And it is doom of man that they forget. It's a good speech by Nicole Williamson. It's really coolly shot. And then Arthur has a speech, which is just, it's bad. Because the men formed a circle around Merlin, and now Arthur's in that circle. And he has these lines like, I will build a round table. And I will build a castle around the hall and all this stuff. And it's just, it's very goofy. It does not come across well. You know, the idea of how the round table was created, yeah, it's neat. You know, like, and where the idea came from is cool, but it's just a very hokey scene and how it's delivered. Now we move to Leodegrance's castle. Guinevere is getting ready for her wedding, and Lancelot has arrived to escort her. You get this moment, fatal moment, when Lancelot enters the castle and she's at the top of the stairs and they catch eyes for the first time. And something's going on between them. And there's plenty of charisma between Guinevere and Lancelot. You don't have to go too far to believe that these two would be fatally attracted to each other. And it's the beginning of the plot that winds its way through the classic legend of, you know, Lancelot and Guinevere. And there's a nice scene where they're riding out. Lancelot is in his armor on his horse. Guinevere rides up next to him and she's saying, you know, my handmaidens are giggling, wanting to know if you will have any of them. And he basically says, no, I've given my heart to one woman, and that's it. And she's like, can I ask who? She's like, you, my lady. And he basically lays it out like, you know, as long as you live, I will love you always, and I will never love another. It's this great tragic theme rises, and you can tell that she's just, like, knocked out by this. And the actor who plays Lancelot, his name is Nicholas Clay, is probably the best actor in this entire film, or, you know, is able to do the best with the not-so-great script that's there. We have the wedding scene, and again, you know, here we are, we're in mythological realism, right? Because at Arthur's wedding, all the knights are all in armor, Arthur's in armor. You know, if you're going to go realism, wearing armor in the medieval period, you wore it when you went off to war, you know? The fucking shit was heavy, it took forever to put on. Like, you wouldn't wear it to your wedding, so it's goofy, and, you know, I kept having to remind myself that, you know, this is a odd mix of some gritty realism, but really in a mythological universe. So at this wedding scene, we meet Morgana, who was Arthur's younger sister, was actually the child of Cornwall and Igraine. And we find out that she is a sorceress, sort of a necromancer of her own right, and she meets Merlin. And she's kind of a Merlin groupie, so she's asking Merlin to teach her, you know, the ways. Merlin asks her some questions like, what is this root, and so on and so forth. And Merlin's kind of impressed with her knowledge up to that point. And we get this notion, too, this throwaway line that the powers of necromancers in this universe are fading, and that the one god comes to drive out the many. And we hear that a couple of times. Next, we're at a scene where Lancelot is out in the forest. And I think in this film, because he's in love with Guinevere, but he will not betray Arthur at this point, he spends a lot of time away from the castle. So he's out in the wilderness, and this young boy is kind of stalking him and runs up to sort of seemingly hold him at knife point, but Lancelot gets the drop on him and tells him to go home. Then when he wakes up again, there's a cooked rabbit not far from where he's sitting, and this young sort of squire's name is Percival, and he begs Lancelot to become his squire, and Lancelot takes him back to the castle with him. And he's kind of put in the kitchen, so on and so forth. So there's this one moment when Lancelot enters the castle and gives Percival to the sort of squire master. Morgana sees the way Guinevere and Lancelot look at each other and kind of puts two and two together. And, you know, in her mind, it's the beginning of her knowledge of, you know, and wanting to plot sort of against them, make some mischief, as it were. Then the camera sort of tracks with Percival as Percival goes through the castle. And he goes through the kitchens and through all these areas. And we get this kind of nice little travelogue of what it's like inside a, you know, medieval castle, as it were, Dark Ages castle. Birds and troubadours and astrologers and all this stuff. And some of it looks goofy, but some of it looks kind of cool, you know. And there's the usual fife and drum music in the background, you know, putting you in the scene. And at one point, he kind of stumbles upon the knights gathering at the round table, and you see from up in the balcony where he's skulking, all these knights sort of gathering around this huge table. It looks kind of cool, actually. The round table in this film looks kind of good. You know, you get a sense that they're all just bored. They're around the round table. They're sitting there, and Arthur says to Merlin, you know, Merlin, you know, have we defeated evil? The land is prosperous. There's no war. You know, things are better than ever. Have we really defeated evil? And Merlin sort of like, you know, good and evil will balance each other out. And Arthur sort of asks him, well, where is it? And Merlin's like, always where you never expect, always, right? And so in the next moment, you know, Gawain, who is played by a young Liam Neeson, Sir Gawain is getting drunk. You know, there's some talk about why Lancelot is never around. He's the best of them. And basically Gawain, because of Morgana whispering in his ear, accuses Guinevere, you know, of being unfaithful with Lancelot, which is why he's not around. There's this thing where, you know, Arthur being the king can't champion her and can't be the knight. And this whole chivalric code where, you know, it's almost like the witch hunts. Like the if two true knights fight each other, you know, if two knights fight each other, the one knight who is true can never lose to the knight who is false, right? So he accuses Guinevere, and Guinevere is kind of pissed that Arthur can't defend her. And then she's about to forgive Gawain, and she's, you know, she says, let Gawain drink from Lancelot's cup in order to imbibe of his goodness and his wisdom. And so there's this great tension where the cup is filled and then passed from person to person and finally gets to Gawain, and he's about to drink from it, and he can. He dashes it down, stands up, and accuses her. And so we're setting up this, you know, this eventual duel between Lancelot and Gawain. Then we're out in the woods, and we're with Lancelot, and Lancelot is having a dream, and this knight shows up. He's lying naked, and this knight shows up, and he battles this knight and is seemingly impaled, and then he wakes up, and we realize that, you know, he's been kind of battling with himself in his dreams. But it's an amazing scene because he actually is, his sword is sort of stabbed through his side. And it's a cool effect shot. Like, for a movie like this, I mean, you know, here's this naked man lying there, and the camera really lingers on him, and it really looks like the sword is in his side, like, in a very mundane way. It looks real. It's really cool. So then we cut back to this tournament, and this is the sort of proving the queen innocent tournament. Gawain is there, and he's like, I demand justice, and none of the knights will stand up for Guinevere. You know, that no one will stand for her, and which is in itself a notion of where the kingdom has gone. Like, these knights are all shiftless and afraid and corrupt and fallen. No one will stand for her, except for young Percival, who stands. And then someone tells him he's not even a knight, so he's knighted right there by Arthur. He basically is given a shield and a lance, and he's sitting atop a horse, and he's about to engage with Gawain. And then Lancelot rides in at the last minute. And he tells Percival, you know, this is my fight. And him and Gawain ride at each other. And before that, we see that Lancelot's, you know, badly wounded from his dream and that sword stuck in his side. So there's blood coming out of his armor. So this is not Lancelot in his prime, but a Lancelot that's greatly wounded. And so they fly at each other at the joust, and they knock each other off horses. And basically, Lancelot's getting his ass kicked. Like, Gawain is pretty much beating him on, you know, from hand to hand. And Lancelot's doing everything he can to hold him off. And it's a great fight. It's another really good, you know, the one-on-one fights in this film are really cool because there's not a lot of cutting. The camera just stays back, and you watch these guys just pummel the shit out of each other. And it's done in a clumsy way that two guys, you know, suited up with all this heavy armor, this is how they might fight, you know? So there's a realism to it. It's not pretty. You know, and it might not even be cinematic, you know, but it's, again, I really respect Boorman's choice to do it in this way. And when they finally get to maces, they both start hacking away at each other with these big maces. It's a really cool scene. I mean, really, the tension ratchets up, and you're in the film because it's really intense, very well choreographed. At one point, Lancelot gets the best of Gawain, and Gawain, sort of, while he's there, is like, I appeal to your mercy, and he shouts out, the queen is innocent. But Lancelot's going to kill him anyway, and he goes for the killing stroke and then completely passes out because he's lost too much blood. Arthur demands Merlin save him, and Merlin, you know, tosses off one of his Analnathrak chants, and so Lancelot begins to heal. And at that point, you know, Guinevere is just, like, completely smitten, and Lancelot heals enough where he's going to take his leave in the forest. Before he does, he's sitting at the round table. For the first time, we've seen him there, and he says to Arthur, we've lost our way. You know, we get the sense that that the king, you know, Camelot and the kingdom, as much as they're prospering, they've kind of lost morally. You know, like they've got everything, they've got every convenience, and they've succeeded, and there's nothing to really test them. And they're kind of in squalor. They're kind of squandering, you know, all this because there's all their flaws are being brought out by the lack of unifying, sort of external aggression or evil, what you will, and they're sort of rotting from within. So Lancelot goes off into the forest, and we've got this, you know, incredibly romantic music. Guinevere gets on a horse, and she goes out there. They're together, and it's done. What happens is she goes out to be with him, and then Merlin and Arthur are on the top of the parapet of the castle. And Merlin's done. He's basically like, Arthur, it's time for me to leave this world. There are other places I need to go. It's kind of a sad moment, you know, because you could tell Merlin's going to miss Arthur and the same. And Arthur kind of hugs him and walks off. And Merlin kind of says to himself, that's it. It's done. So now we get this cutback back and forth, these two parallel sequences going on at the same time. One sequence is Guinevere and Lancelot, you know, together in the forest, going at it. Then we have Morgana and Merlin. And Morgana's finally after what she says, you know, Merlin hasn't taught her, which is this certain spell of making. And Merlin sort of like, okay, you really want to learn it, follow me. And so they go down into this sort of subterranean place that he calls sort of, you know, this is the dragon or the seed of the dragon. And as he's leading her down there, Arthur discovers Guinevere and Lancelot asleep, naked, you know, after having just had sex. There's this cool scene where Merlin briefly turns around and his staff is lit up. And he goes, you know, look into the eyes of the dragon and despair. And I cast you out. And he basically is going to obliterate Morgana because he's telling her like what a petty sorceress she is, sowing evil everywhere. And so he's going to destroy her. But at the same time, Arthur comes upon Lancelot and Guinevere, rams Excalibur into the ground. And at the minute he does that, we see sort of an Excalibur also go through Merlin. So that it's kind of murky. It's kind of this notion of Arthur severed his connection to the land and to the dragon, and the dragon was a lot of the sorcery that allowed Merlin to thrive and survive. In the midst of him about to destroy Morgana, Merlin is sort of, his power is weakened, seriously weakened, and he's really damaged. So Morgana seizes this moment, and as he's disoriented, sort of tells him, you know, use the charm of making, save yourself. And so as he chance the charm to heal himself, she finally learns it. And at this moment, she's more powerful than he is and imprisons him. It's kind of a cool sequence. It's boffo and weird and all these weird noises and how things are cut back and the naked lovers and Arthur and the sword. And it's such a weird movie. But it's cool. It kind of has its moments, you know. And eventually, Morgana completely imprisons Merlin inside this odd-looking sort of icicle prison. And at that moment, the two lovers wake and they see the sword is there. Arthur is not, but the sword is. And they realize that Arthur has discovered them. And Lancelot freaks out and just runs away. And Igraine runs to the other direction. And they scatter. So now that Morgana briefly has this power. And she bewitches Arthur. And basically, in the same way that Merlin allowed Uther to lie with Igraine, stay with me on this, by turning him into the likeness of the Duke of Cornwall, Morgana does it to herself, turning her sort of into the likeness of Guinevere. So she has sex with Arthur, impregnates herself, and all this time uses this charm of making. And then there's this crazy scene. They flash forward to Morgana pregnant and having her own son. And she's pregnant and like she pulls her own son out of her womb. She's up on this altar and, you know, basically having the baby by herself, pulls the baby out of her womb on her own. It's a cool scene. I mean, never seen anything like it, frankly. And then I think it's a cut back and forth moment still. Arthur is praying on the steps in the chapel of Camelot. Some lightning sort of comes out of nowhere and strikes him down, and he basically goes into some horrible sickness. Cut to a knight riding through this dying land, and people are crying for food, and we can see that nothing is growing at the end of it. And the knights all gather at the round table, and Arthur's just, you could see that he's done, and he's basically telling them, you know, we've got to find the Grail. That's the only way, is to find the Holy Grail. You know, none of the knights are like, well, where do we look for it? He's like, I don't know. You know, signs, portents, Intuition, you know, follow God's lead, and you will be led to the Grail. It's kind of a spiritual quest. So then we get these shots of all these knights riding out. It's kind of cool, actually. A lot of the scenes, a lot of these knights fail and they die. And so we see just a lot of great landscape shots of, I'm assuming, these are places in Britain or the United Kingdom. We follow Percival mostly. He is on horse and he goes through these various landscapes and just this beautiful shots of the mist on mountains. And then he's in a sort of a cold wasteland and he's up on this plateau. It's a really cool shot when he comes upon this knight. And from a distance, it looks like a knight's just sort of taking shelter in this little stone house. And he rides up to it, and then the camera is in front of the knight. And we see that the knight is just a skeleton in his armor. But it's creepy, and it's really well done. He's just kind of, the knight must have, like, died on his knees and just kind of, you know, was frozen there by time and the rust on his armor. So you realize that, you know, they've been looking for the Grail now for years, and no one has found it. And now at one point, Percival's riding into a forest and he sees Gawain, Liam Neeson, dead on his horse. And the horse is sort of running out of the forest with Gawain on top of it. And now they're in the land of Mordred, who is Morgana's son. Percival rides into this forest and he hears this little laughing. We see this young boy dressed in this golden armor. And it's Charlie Borman. Another Borman appears. He says, "Are you looking for the Grail?" And, you know, "Yes, I am. Follow me." And so he follows this young Charlie Borman. And we get into this clearing where there's this tree where there's like a dozen knights hanging from it. It's very gruesome. And we see one close up. A raven lands on one, and it's like pecking at his eyes. And we keep looking at it, and the raven actually plucks out his eyeball and flies away. It's really gruesome, like a very realistically gruesome scene. Cool effects, but like not CGI, just gross. So now we are taken into this cave, and Morgana is in there, and, you know, young Mordred has brought Percival in, and we realize that it's been 10 years, and so Morgana is going to tempt Percival, and she's saying, "You must be tired, please drink from this cup," and so on and so forth. And there's this whole kind of, there's this test that she puts him through, and he passes, in the sense that he doesn't fall for her, doesn't become like her undead knight, as it were. And so then we snap out of it, and we realize everything we've been seeing is kind of a vision. And then little Mordred is like, "He's no good, mother." And so they hang him from this tree. As he's hanging from the tree, he's getting closer and closer to death. And at one point, he passes out, and then we get this shot of him standing before this castle. We don't know where it is. The drawbridge opens. And he walks in, clad in like just like a loincloth of a long loincloth of some sort. And we hear this disembodied voice, really cool voice. We see the Grail floating. We hear, "What is the secret of the Grail? Who does it serve?" And Percival freaks out, runs away. At the same moment, there's a knight hanging above him. And this has all been a vision, but in back in the real movie. The knight that hanging above him had the stirrup of its boot has been slowly cutting into the cord that Percival is being hung from. At that moment, as he's running away from the Grail in his vision, afraid, stirrup finally cuts through the last cord and Percival is saved. Now you have an older Mordred in his 20s, probably another 10 years has passed or so, visits Arthur and he's got the great golden armor again. It's really cool. And there's this great reveal where the camera is placed as if it was inside the castle. And as the drawbridge of the castle lowers, it reveals Mordred, like, from his head down. It's a really great dramatic shot. The movie is full of these. And as you're going through this movie, and whatever its flaws is, it's amazingly shot. And Borman really has an incredible eye. And Mordred is flanked by some very realistic-looking men in regular armor, you know, but the armor looks terrific, as all the armor does in this film. It just looks heavy and dense and tough, and it's got chinks in it, and it's dirty. Mordred is demanding the crown of Britain. Arthur says, I can only give you my love. And Mordred's like, "That's the only thing I don't want." And he basically threatens that he's going to return to Camelot with armed men. And the next scene we see, Mordred and his men are chasing down Uriens, who we've met earlier in the film as the one who knighted Arthur in that incredible shot by Leodegrance's castle. And Uriens is being run down by Mordred and his men. He's eventually killed, but Percival's sort of hiding in the forest nearby. And when they all ride away, Uriens, as he's dying, basically tells Percival that he's the last knight alive and everyone's failed and it's all up to him now. And then we have this great sequence where this wailing is heard and Percival sort of follows it. And we go to this little village where they're burying all these dead, probably people who have starved or been dead of plague. And we hear this incredible wailing. And then there's this crazy fanatical leader. And we realize under all of it that it's Lancelot, and he's become this wild hermit. He sees Percival, and he basically tells the townspeople, like, this is a knight. These are, you know, the failed guardians of our land, and, you know, we should kill them. And they all kind of gather around Percival and throw him in the water in his armor. You know, Percival basically drowns, from what we can tell. But again, as he's close to death, he is back at the drawbridge in that castle, and it opens up. And he walks in, and this time, you know, he hears the voice, what is the secret of the Grail? Who does it serve? Percival now answers without hesitation, you, my lord. And he says, well, who are you? You are my lord and king. You are Arthur. In a sense, and this is a very odd thing, because the little bit of Arthuriana literature that I've been reading, the Grail quest is a spiritual quest, and I'm going to talk about it in Christian terms because that's the way it's portrayed when you read this Grail literature, Arthuriana literature. It's heavily Christianized. The notion of the Grail is this, you know, within. You know, I think the real metaphor is here. The Grail is within. Actually, achieving communion with the Holy Grail is when you sort of shuffle off your ego and your pride and all these sins that, you know, the Catholics have the seven deadly sins, right? Pride, sloth, greed, and all that. And the notion is that when you have proven, in a sense, that you've really, really renounced these sins for good, you have kind of given up everything that goes along with them and surrendered your life to God, that is the Grail. That what happens within you is this incredible spiritual transformation. That is as if you've drank from a cup of some of them. You know, in a sense, you're drinking God. From what I've been reading, I mean, that's kind of how I'm putting it together. That's what it is about. It threw me a little bit when I was like, when it says, who am I? You're Arthur. But I guess in some way, too, what they're saying is that Arthur and the land are one, and the dragon and Arthur and the land is sort of the spirit of God and is sort of all wrapped up together. I mean, that's what I'm imagining. Or, you know, just Boorman didn't understand really what Grail Quest is meant. But I think it has more to do with Arthur and his connection to the land and that relationship being sort of within God's grace in some way. But I could be completely wrong. And please email me with other perspectives because I'm learning the spiritual bent of this literature and it's fascinating to me. And it's also not very clear very often. In a sense, you know, the problem with this is Percival really hasn't earned the right to receive the Grail. We haven't seen Percival do it. I mean, yes, Percival survived sort of being tempted by Morgana, right? So I guess in that sense, there was a spiritual test that he passed. He did not fall into, you know, sort of her clutches. And I guess the reward for that is the Grail for him. But it's just the theme in this movie is so clumsily handled that other than here and there and incredible scenes where it's beautifully handled, you know, there's no real arc. None of these characters really do anything except engage in scenes in this film. So suddenly Percival is there back at Camelot and he moves toward Arthur and he gives him the Grail and Arthur drinks. And there's this great line. Arthur says, I did not know how empty was my soul until it was filled. And Arthur's sort of waking up now and he has this great line where he says, quote, I've lived through others far too long. Lancelot carried my honor, Guinevere my guilt, Mordred bore my sins, my knights have fought my causes. You know, the problem with it, it's so on the nose that the metaphor is being trampled underfoot. But the movie's trying to get at Arthur recognizing, you know, what his earthly rule has been like and how he has lived. And in a sense, you know, the sacrifice of Percival has allowed him to sort of get a sense of this new way he could be in the world, but it's very clumsily done. And yet, it's a nice scene in itself, because in that scene, you know, Nigel Terry really nails it. And Nigel Terry always looks, I mean, if there's any criticism I have of him in this film, is sometimes he's emphatic to a goofy sense, but he's always convicted in his portrayal of Arthur. And I think it allows scenes like this to kind of still live, even though they're kind of poorly constructed. So now Sir Kay, who's, you know, Arthur's brother and still his main counselor, they rouse the troops and we hear Carmona Burana again, the Carl Orff theme. They all gather together and ride out towards battle. And as they're riding, the land is blooming around them and really bad special effects. We're getting this idea that Arthur and the land are now connected again. and life is coming back to the land as Arthur rides into battle. And Arthur goes to a nunnery and visits Guinevere, where I guess she's been since her dalliance with Lancelot, and he asks her forgiveness. It's a really sweet scene of like an old married couple. You know, you figure Arthur's going to be there and demand her repentance or whatever, but he asks her forgiveness, and I guess it's more for, you know, for her having to love a king, which was, you know, his first duty is to the land and to his kingdom. And he's king first and husband second. And so he's kind of apologizing for the lack of love that he, in a sense, deprived her of, which I think is beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful little scene and it's played really well. And she's so touched by it. And they really have this tender reconciliation. It's really wonderful. And she's kept Excalibur and she goes and gets it out of her little case and he's blown away. And in a sense, his humility has restored it. Like, you know, if he stormed in there and was like, listen, bitch, blah, 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 I doubt she would have given him the sword back. But like, I feel like in the theme of the film, and his kingly humility has restored, you know, his relationship to the land and now Excalibur as well. And now we're getting, you know, the Wagner is swelling and we've got the eve before the battle and we have Arthur walking around what looks like kind of Stonehenge-like artifacts, calling out to Merlin. And there's this cool scene when he strikes his fist against the side of one of these Stonehenge pieces. Briefly, you see the underwater chamber where Merlin was imprisoned flashes to life briefly and then darkens. A really neat shot. Arthur, because he has now come back to the land and his connection is restored, he's woken up Merlin. He has the power to do this. Merlin basically has a brief moment with Arthur. Now, Merlin only lives in dreams now. So there's a brief moment where Merlin looks at Arthur and Arthur's like, you know, are you a dream? And he says, a dream to some, a nightmare to others, and he vanishes. And we get this sense that Arthur's talking to other knights and they've all kind of dreamed of Merlin. And we get the sense that Merlin now only lives in their dreams, which I think is cool. So he doesn't come back fully. Like he was damaged to a certain point. Morgana damaged him in such a certain point that, you know, he now only can live in their subconscious, which I think is great. And so now he appears to Morgana in Mordred's camp. She's sleeping. And what we don't realize is that the interaction between the two of them now is all in her dreams. But in her dreams, he causes her to start chanting the charm of making and create a fog. And, you know, he plays to her vanity to get her to do it. He's like, oh, can you really do the charm of making? Is this possible? So she creates this fog. And what he tells her is that, you know, all this power that you're using, you can't use it on keeping yourself young and beautiful because she looks exactly the same as she did 20 years earlier. You know, Merlin recognizes that she's been using the dragon's power to keep herself young. And so for her to use it on another large enterprise would drain her of power. And so Mordred gets wind of this fog emanating from her tent and he storms in. And there's this toothless, like really, really old, incredibly ugly woman there. Looks at him with like this one tooth. And Mordred is like horrified and he just stabs her. And so Morgana dies at the hand of her son. So then we have the final battle between Mordred's forces and Arthur's, and it's all done in this dense fog. So it's really not much of a battle. There's a lot of shots of knights beating the crap out of each other. There's a lot of blood. You know, it's realistic and gritty in its way, but it's very confusing. And obviously, you know, the film is saying they're in a fog, so we're all confused. I feel like Borman sort of took a way out because I don't think he really knew how to stage a big battle like this, or maybe he didn't have money. So just becomes knights blundering around in the fog, killing each other. At some point, Lancelot comes sort of in its Han Solo moment. He starts kicking everyone's ass and, you know, he doesn't have any armor on, so he's mortally wounded. And it's a nice last scene between Lancelot and Arthur when Lancelot sort of asking Arthur for his forgiveness. And Arthur says, of course, you know, you are totally forgiven. You are always been its greatest knight. And so Lancelot sort of dies absolved of his sins, which is kind of a cool moment. And then we have this final moment between Mordred and Arthur, and it's a very stern, tough little scene where Mordred's like, come, father, let's join each other in death. And so the camera's back a little ways, and Mordred has this lance with this nasty-looking tip, and he basically stabs Arthur completely through the gut, right? But Arthur kind of works his way forward on the lance to get closer to Mordred and then stabs him with Excalibur. It's a cool, brutal, gruesome scene, but very tough. Reminded me of the scene in Lord of the Rings at the end of Fellowship of the Ring Aragorn is fighting that huge Uruk-hai orc. He stabs him, but the orc sort of laughs at him and runs up the sword, and then Aragorn has to sort of behead him for some. I always think, did Jackson get that from this film? So then this is an odd moment. Percival is sort of one of the last knights left, and he comes to Arthur's side, and Arthur's dying. And so Arthur tells Percival, take Excalibur, run, find a pool of water, and throw it in. So we follow Percival, and he finds this beautiful pool, and it's a beautiful place. I mean, the filming is just incredible. You know, you see this wonderful lake in the midst of the mountains, and it's misty and just beautifully shot. So Percival's about to throw it in. I think the hand comes up, possibly to catch it, in that woman's hand who gave it up in the first place. And then he turns around, puts it back in his saddle, and rides all the way back to Arthur. And Arthur's like, you know, tell me what you saw. And Percival's like, oh, I couldn't do it. And Arthur's like, dude, you got to go do it. So he rides all the way back there. And the camera follows him all the way back. And it's just, I don't understand. I mean, the film's clocking over 2 hours now. You didn't need two trips for Percival. You know, you really didn't. But finally, Percival gets the unction up, and he throws the sword in, and the arm that we've seen a couple of times in the film reaches up, grasps the sword, and it vanishes under the waves. And then he comes back, and there's this funeral barge that's already leaving the shore with Arthur on it. And so we look from a distance as Percival sees Arthur being borne out on this otherworldly funeral barge. Obviously, the gods are taking Arthur home, or God is taking Arthur home. And there's this beautiful last shot where, you know, you see the boat dwarfed by the sea and these incredible dark clouds. That's it. That is the end of Excalibur. This was in 1981, so just to talk about the author-related items that have come out since then, there was a film called First Knight. It came out in 1995 that starred Sean Connery as Arthur, Richard Gere as Lancelot. It was pretty much a glossy nothing movie. And then there was, I think, a miniseries on Sci-Fi that was taken from Marion Zimmer Bradley's The Mists of Avalon, which is Arthuriana from a woman's point of view. And I didn't see that. I think that came out in 2001. And then in 2004, there was an Anton Fuqua, who's an action movie director. There was a film that came out called King Arthur, basically, and starred, I believe, Clive Owen, Keira Knightley as Guinevere. But in this is an odd, a much more realistic film in terms of, I don't remember there being much magic. It's very much Arthur versus, you know, the Britons. And Guinevere is like this Celtic ninja. It was pretty bad and had absolutely nothing to do with King Arthur or the themes of knighthood or anything. At this point, it's now January 2015, and Guy Ritchie is looking to redo Arthur in a King Arthur film of his own. From what I can tell, they're trying to go the historical route and do something about, you know, Arthur uniting Britain to oust the Romans. But, you know, whatever. I think the spiritual aspect of this story is now lost on our incredibly didactic, literal-minded society that we have now. The metaphor is not very popular these days, and it makes, to me, I love that Boorman tried to get at some of this stuff. I mean, it wasn't very successful, and yet I love this film. I watch this film every 2 or 3 years. I rewatch it because I love, there are certain times in this film where the music, the landscape, and the theme, and the everything comes together to just really blow you away. Like every time I cry, that Arthur scene where, you know, he lays down and gives Excalibur to Uriens. Every time, there's tears. It's just such a beautiful scene. The movie is a boffo mess. I mean, it's a mess. And again, the Foley work and the sound are such that it just really takes you out of the film very often. But it's shot beautifully, and there are wonderful themes there. The music is great. So, you know, for a wonky film that it is, it's really one that I really like. And so that wraps up our Sci-Fi on Screen episode on Excalibur. You can find us at scifionscreen.com. You can find us at Sci-Fi on Screen on Facebook. And we are on iTunes, and we're on, you know, you can, any mobile device that has a sort of podcast app, just type in Sci-Fi on Screen, and we will be there for the taking. Hope you guys enjoy the show, and looking forward to next time.